welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program, broadcast on the Community Radio Network. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time.
This is a special Baby Boomers edition. I'm Rob Greaves, and welcome to Listen to Older Voices and part two of a three-part program on the life and times of 66-year-old Glyn Mason. Being a baby boomer, Glyn's life, like most baby boomers, is significantly different to previous generations. In part one of his story, Glyn outlined how his family came to Australia post-World War II as part of the opportunity for servicemen and women to gain assisted passage and to set up a new life in Australia. However, the work opportunities for his father were better in New Zealand, and so the family moved there. Music and all its side associations were part of Glyn's upbringing at home. This week, we learned that Glyn had a good education, but was never really comfortable with the thought of taking up a traditional profession. For Glyn, it was a life of music and graphic design that really captured his imagination. It was at high school that he first experienced playing music in a band, and this was the early to mid-1960s, when the music explosion was really happening in both New Zealand and Australia, in fact, around the world. By the time he left school, playing live music was a major part of his life. In unravelling his life, we are educated and entertained with his stories of how his personal music life and the general music scene was developing in that explosion. This is a journey and a story that is engrossing and well told. So sit back as we pick up with Glyn talking about his life at school. Did you enjoy going to school?
I was not a good student, you know, in terms of my marks, you know, let's put it that way. But I greatly enjoyed athletics, history, art, and the stuff that I learnt for some strange, uncanny reason, whether it was at high school or when I went to art school post-high school, they stuck me in these classes with all these other geniuses, right? I don't know why I was there, because Mr. Quinn, my Latin teacher, I must have been an absolutely disgusting disappointment to him for the 3 years that I was doing it, because I was bottom of the class for 3 years. And the same in mathematics. Never got maths, never got geometry, couldn't understand it. And it was like, oh, well, you know, what the heck am I doing this for? And, of course, you know, it was all part of trying to make you a rounded human and a rounded person, you know. But, like, you know, I couldn't...
Just couldn't switch on.
Couldn't switch on. Never got it, you know.
So how far did you go with formal education?
Up to fifth form, right. Which over there it's called school leaving, or was called.
I think it was called leaving here as well.
Yeah, so, look, so many gals and, you know, guys, a lot of my friends all bailed out. They went to work to get money and do stuff. So they left and, you know, the girls were off doing office things and the guys were, you know, joining crews on boats and being stewards over to England and back. And, you know, these were my friends.
Yes.
And just heading off to Points West because they just couldn't stand another year at school. And they had no desire, unless they were achieving seriously high marks and stuff, did they ever want to go and follow, you know, the classics, you know, medicine, science at uni and all that, and yeah, all that kind of stuff.
So doing your leaving year, would have been what, 15 16?
That's right.
16, which means that would have been in the mid-60s,
yeah,
approximately,
correct,
when, well, which we mentioned earlier, the music explosion had happened overseas and it was really happening here now.
Yep.
When did you first pick up an instrument and start playing with somebody else?
At high school, because I had a friend of mine was a very natural guitar player, Chaz Kennedy, and he was on the stage when he was 11, just playing in talent shows and stuff, right? Just used to thing. And I wasn't envious of him. I actually went to a couple of the talent shows he was on and thought how fantastic he was and how great, you know, that was. And I hadn't really thought about it at the time. And so when all of the music, you know, started to kind of really take hold and you were going to school dances and a lot of my friends were in the band, yes. that played at the school dance, right? Yes. They'd formed an outfit at this point, and they were doing Shadows tunes and whatever else was pre the kind of the singing Beatles thing kind yep. of world. Yep. So they were doing all that stuff. And Kiwiland was quite on top of the music scene very well, because with a lot of the boats and stuff coming out, and this continued right through into the Vietnam War years and stuff, a lot of the R&R troops and stuff, and the American ships, you know, cruising the Pacific, stopped in New Zealand and all partied on. That was yep. the rest and recreation area. Yeah. Well, a lot of the guys working on the English boats, on the cruise ships and stuff, they had the most unbelievable record collections. They had all the new stuff from England, which was like, if you remember, the soul era. So they had all the Stax Vault stuff. They had all the blues, both English and American, you know, and they just had it all, you know, because it was happening over there.
That's right. And you couldn't buy that. Well, not readily here.
Yeah, and it wasn't really happening here.
That's right.
So it sort of came as a kind of a wave, you know. Mm. And anyway, a lot of my friends knew those guys, you know, and somehow the connection started. And the next thing you know, there's New Zealand's building up, and it's always been a fairly sort of inbred but really interesting scene in music, as you know. You know, like, you have a look at the talent that's been Dave Dobbin and Split Enz, and you know,
unbelievable in proportion to the population.
Yeah, you know, and it had all its stars over there, just like it. You had your Cold Joys and everyone here. If you take the same era in New Zealand, you had exactly the same thing going on. The Johnny Devlin, Dinah Lee, you know, it all sort of came up in a parody sort of. So yeah, at school was my earliest sort of thing, and Chaz was doing his stuff. Eventually, we thought, oh, this would be really good. Why don't we get a band? You know, let's do a band. You know, and so. You know, some friends of his got together, and we, you know, I joined, and we used to rehearse, you know, much to the you know, destruction of our folks' ears in the lounge rooms and stuff. And it seriously was in the lounge rooms in
yes.
those days.
Oh, yes.
Forget the garage.
Oh, no, it's lounge room.
That was the family car. Right?
That's right.
No, this just had to be done sort of in there. And by the time I left school, we were playing around the Hutt Valley. And all the English thing that was going on was the Stones and the Beatles and Pretty Things, all the Wild, and you know, and so all that music had been taken in, and Chaz was like right into, and of course the Hendrix, and man, you know, like, so we had this band called the Roadrunners, and we played all of that stuff, you know, just like, you know, everything you could lay your hands on, so. Not much writing, just primarily covers.
Like,
oh, yes. No, we hadn't gone down that road yet.
Yes.
You know, I couldn't even consider writing a song. I thought, oh, well, I'll just pick these ones up.
And besides, the audiences wanted to hear what they knew then, didn't they? They were listening on the radio. Yeah. They want to hear you play.
Yeah, popular music.
Yes, that's right.
Know, popular music, right? So we played all that stuff, and we used to play in Wellington quite a bit. The Intermezzo Coffee Lounge was one of our sort of favourite hangout gigs, because if you remember in England, there was the whole thing between the mods and the rockers. Mm-hmm. Well, in Wellington, there wasn't that going on, but there was a fraternity of mods, and they all used to drive around on Vespa scooters.
Oh, okay.
With Union Jacks painted on the side and all that stuff.
Yes.
And they used to frequent this club and thought we were great because we played all the British music, right? So that was a sort of move into what you might understand, you know.
So while you're doing that, you've left school. Did you have to get a job?
No. Well, I basically, as soon as I left school, I applied to go to Wellington Polytechnic, graphic design.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sort of, you know, and got accepted.
Was that something you had a passion about then?
Art was one of my things.
That's what you said,
I
liked
at school.
Art.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
So went and did that, got accepted, in I go, and they stick me in this class with all these other really freaking brilliant people, right? And half of my class had been out in the field for a year or two, working, just doing their things, right? So there was like amazing graphic artists and stuff. But in listening to their stories of, like, you know, I used to, there was regular things going on. It's just like a uni, really. Mm. Regular things going on. So you go and have a year four meet. You know, kids who'd been there for 4 years studying, right? And they'd been out doing their stuff. And I used to say, well, what's going on out there? Like, you know, what you know, are you happy doing what you're doing? And they said, well, not really, because so many of these people had the unbelievable skills, but they were in a job in advertising doing newspaper layout.
Hmm. Which is a bit of a downer for your creativity. Yes.
Well, yeah, so the creativity side of things, the only people that really justified had, what can I say, in my memory, two of them were one guy who'd gone on to be a car designer.
Okay.
So he was able to do lots of freelance kind of graphic work and let his imagination get in on board. Another one went to work for a publishing company and he did all the covers for books.
Right.
So he could just go nuts, right?
But they're the exceptions to the rule, aren't they?
Well, that's what it appeared to be.
Yes.
You know, and I mean, some of them probably would have really gone on to be, I'm sure, fabulously famous artists that I never knew.
Did this dismay you, these stories? Did it?
No, not really. I was probably disappointed. But by the same token, it gave the more urgency to the growing I'm playing music down here.
Right.
So I just decided that there was only three of the tutors at the college that were in any good, in my estimation, that took the time and bothered to spend some time with me. The rest of them were too busy looking after the really good kids, right? And I went to mum and dad one day, and at that point I'd been playing and I'd also been bunking a few classes to go and listen to other bands and stuff in town. And I just went to them, I said, look, you know, don't waste your money anymore. This is a complete waste of time. I'm just going to go and get a job and I'm going to keep playing. And within a year from that point, I was out on the road playing with a band in New Zealand called The Bitter End. Like live.
And mum and dad were happy with that decision?
No.
like all of them.
No, of course not.
Listen to older voices. The magic of memories.
This is a special Baby Boomers edition.
No. I think mum was, you know, probably, she was always pretty smart. She probably knew what was going on, you know. And dad was just disappointed. He probably thought, well, you know, you should stick at that and you'll have a real job.
But you can understand now in retrospect what they went through, and they saw this as your big opportunity for you to break out of their mould.
Yeah, but I don't think they thought that at all. I think they just thought that I was a stupid idiot for letting the teaching and the you know, the polytechnic thing go.
But that's what I mean, that you had this opportunity, the world was at your feet to have a career.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm going to play music.
Yeah, that was dad's idea. Yeah, you know, yeah. Well, you know, and yeah, I mean, I get it.
We all get it.
Like, you know, yes. Having been and watching, you know, your children and out, you know, and all that. And parents, I'm sure, forever have gone down these roads, right? Like, you know, just forever. And
so you got your first professional band going?
Well, not mine.
You were in a professional band.
Yeah, I was just in a pro band, and the place was going nuts, like the rest of the world. And there was like 9 million professional bands going buntering out there and doing it. And it was exciting and wild, you know, and it was crazy stuff. And we were touring in a mishmash, like I'm pretty sure it was here. Because I only knew music there at that time, you got to remember. I knew nothing about Australian music at all. And I knew the rest of the world because I used to get, you know, New Musical Express and magazines from Australia. And the only, later on, the only way that I knew about Australian music was they used to have weekly maybe, the Everybody's magazine, which was like Post and stuff. And in the middle of Everybody's magazine, they used to have a pop section, right? Well, that was a publication brought into New Zealand. You could pick it up at Wickham and Turns, you know, just like your newspapers and magazines. And I used to go and grab it. And I'd read through and there was all the stuff, Purple Hearts and Wild Cherries and bloody all that kind of stuff. Oh, wow, you know, that's what's going on. But over there, rock bands like here had the struggle to try and overcome standardised music. So standardised music over there, which were like school orchestras and classical music and blah, 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 and the entertainment world. Mm. Because if you remember here and worldwide, there was the travelling variety shows.
That's right.
You know, the black and white minstrels, right. Hush, hush. you know, and we can't mention that now. Anybody who paints their face black. you know, because my mum and dad were musical and they loved it. They loved going to that stuff. So we used to go to all those shows.
Mm. Like, variety shows.
Yeah, all the English entertainers coming over, Frank Ifield, and that. You know, we'd go to the lot. So usually there'd be a band involved. But as you would understand, it was the band that read the charts that played behind the main acts.
Yes.
So it'd be, you know, whatever it was. And then slowly, slowly, these tours would start happening, and there'd be sort of like rock bands in there. Well, what you and I don't think is a rock band, but
then,
yeah, yes. And there'd be like Sounds Incorporated.
Oh gosh, you know, I forgot about them. Yes.
No, but they'd be, because they came over with the Beatles.
Right? That's right. That's, you know, right. That's
and the
right.
Searchers.
That's right.
Well, they came with them, but the Sounds Incorporated, the big band hangover, they were much earlier. They came out with a lot of different things. So here I was in this band called The Bitter End, and, like, you know, we were caught up in the mid to late 60s thing. So, like, I had leggings made out of a bear skin. I had Union Jack trousers and an army jacket, right? You know, like the Who thing, like you know, and everyone's trying to be rebels and you know, what did they used to call their music? Kinetic art, when he used to smash.
Kinetic art, that's right.
You know, guitars and they, you know, in England they were trying to, how many people could you fit into a phone box in that era?
Yeah, or a mini.
And the music was all that, the pop art.
Yes,
thing,
yes.
Right?
It was pop
anyway,
art.
So I was part of that, like coming through. And that's sort of what with The Bitter End was doing. We were doing like My Generation, all kind of, all that stuff. Going nuts, and Peter Hall, the singer, would be throwing maracas up and smashing them with a guitar head and all that kind of stuff, you know. And so we were touring, and one of the classic tours I'll never forget, and I'll try to be really brief. On the tour was a guy called Lou Prime, right? Who was New Zealand's version of Heinz, right? And he, like, same blonde hair, super pale skin, and a blonde bouffant. And he did that whole, you know, shimmy, shimmy, like rockabilly, you know. And then Miss Bay of Plenty. She, who was this Maori, like really lovely looking Maori girl who'd won this Miss Bay of Plenty contest. Oh, okay. And her claim to fame on the variety show that we played at was that she was a really good poi dancer with the poise.
Okay.
And then there was Jerry Merito, who used to be part of the Howard Morrison Quartet, that were huge of the first group members that used to come between Australia and New Zealand as entertainers.
Okay.
And that's where, like, that whole thing started to build up here. Okay. Max Merida be coming over, and Diane Alea be coming over, and Aussie guys would be going back there, and gals, right?
Yes.
So, you know, Lynn, you know, I forget, what was the name? The Aussie entertainers of the time, you know, Cole Joy be going over there. And so the agency things would grab both sides of the entertainment, and they'd be swapping them over across the Tasman. Mm-hmm. So all this was starting to happen. Right, and we were part of this tour, and I mean Jerry Merito, who'd been the funny guy playing guitar and stuff in the Howard Morrison Quartet, who were huge in New Zealand, like gods, right, on the variety circuit. He was now a member on his own because they'd busted up, and I mean away we went, and man, it was just nuts, man. It was his tour,
yes.
So his idea of the accommodation was staying at his tribe's meeting places on, like, Tolaga Bay, as you went up the east coast and the Maori reservation, you know, Maori sort of towns and stuff going up. And man, you know, it was just
rough.
It was just nuts.
Just nuts, know? Just like, crazy.
Yeah, because all the women on the tour were sleeping on that side of the meeting house, and all the guys are sleeping on this side, right?
Oh, okay. Okay.
And away, like, it was just nuts, you know. Yeah. And we were the token rock band. Yeah, you know. So after that, life became pretty much that's what I was doing.
Yeah,
and it was easy for me to sort of slide in and out of it. And after The Bitter End, I think, I can't remember exactly what happened, but I think we we had a band again in Lower Hutt or the Hutt Valley, made up of a group of friends of mine, and we called ourselves Jigsaw. So it wasn't Johnny Chester's Jigsaw, it was the Jigsaw over there. And we did all that stuff. We did Hendrix and the whole shebang, because Chaz was in it, and he was a mighty, mighty guitar player. And the world had really changed into that English psychedelia thing. A lot of the guys you'd know, like Reno Tahi from Compulsion and stuff, they'd all gone to England with a band from Wellington called Sounds Unlimited, right? Another brass kind of big house band in a club there, famous, had a residency for like 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
Anyway, they cut out and went, we just got to, you know, change the world, man. We've got to break the mold. This is really boring here. So they all packed up en masse and went over to England. Well, no one heard anything of them for about 4 or 5 months. The next thing, you know, Sounds and Unlimited back in town, like live at the so-and-so. Well, we all charged in to see them because we liked them. Well, mate, Reno had a Hendrix thing, right?
Yes.
He had the Strat, the whole, all that was going on. The rest of the band, Johnny McCormick, the sax player, had like, you know, scarves tied around his thing, and he had his sax going through a wire pedal, right? So their world had completely just gone 360 upside down.
Yes.
Or, you know, whatever, 180. And that it all was part of the New Zealand scene. The whole world had changed.
Yes.
And at around about that time, Normie Rowe came out, because this was this transition thing. There was an Aussie band called The Pleasers, with a spelt with a Z, that used to come over, and then Normie Rowe came over and he toured over there in the gold caftan days with the big sideburns, right? And he played up at the Levin North Footy Club, you know, which was this frigging corrugated iron shit. And the support act was three Maoris called the Shriek Machine, right?
Right.
A Hendrix derivative kind of bunch of nutters, right? And it was, that's how it was mad, you know, and that's how it was. It was a massive jumping and growing and the whole thing. I think it's a very exciting period. I think the world of music like that, you know, to my understanding from anything I ever remember in magazines and stuff, the world was going mad. And I've spoken to you about this before, you know, that great series, the Dancing in the Street.
Oh, yes.
Well, like, I knew very little, for example, about the American San Fran scene, right? I had some great music that I had on record from there, just because I liked the records and I'd seen it in a record shop. Love, and I can't remember this other band I used to really love. Anyway, and knew nothing about that. And yet, when their records were now being played on the radio. Creedence Clearwater was coming up through the ranks. Jefferson Starship, Airplane, as it was then. And on it went, right? And I used to think, wow, that's pretty wild stuff. You know, what is that? You know, and of course, everything came with it, the fashions, you know, Paisley and oil lights and all that stuff. And so that just kind of continued through to 69, which is why I came back here.
Did you come back here specifically, or did you come back here because you thought there were better opportunities, or was it for a
friend? It was kind of out of the blue, in actual fact. There was a band in New Zealand called Larry's Rebels, and they were massively commercially successful, like huge, probably like number one for about 4 to 5 years or something, continually, you know, pop band, good looking guy out the front, great entertainer, bingo, you know, sort of very Valentine's issue or something equivalent in Australia, you know, that kind of sort of thing. And they'd been here about four times before I even joined the band. And they were massive here. They had like pyrotechnic things going off, and they wore multicoloured suits, like, you know, yellow, red, green and blue and everything. And they were big in Australia, you know, coming up. And in New Zealand, Larry got busted. And I was playing up there with Jigsaw in Auckland. And they used to come down and socialise. Heaps of great musicians, like everywhere. You know, he'd come down and have drinks and party on and stuff. Anyway, when he did, they came in and just said, do you want to join the band? And at that point, I mean, Jigsaw was really a good band. But I wasn't ever, at the time, looking back on it now, I wouldn't even know where it would have gone. You know, like, we were a great playing band, but there was lots of great playing bands. Like,
yes,
you know, just
yes.
Like, oh, yeah, okay. We had no record contract, nothing.
Right.
And they just sort of said, look, you know, Larry's not doing it. Do you want to be the singer? And I kind of, the obvious question is, well, what are you doing? You know, what's in it sort of thing. And they said, well, we're recording a record, and we're doing a tour, and we're going to Australia, right? Back to Australia. And I went, oh, back to Australia, eh?
Tempting.
You know, and I just kind of thought, well, okay. And chronologically, I can't remember what was happening in Jigsaw. I wasn't sure whether the band was either breaking up. I actually can't remember, right? But obviously I remember leaving, and I joined the Rebels, and we made that album. And they also wanted to, it was my early, like a lot of people, early fledgling moments of trying to write songs.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
This was the kind of like the starting point, because there were bands in New Zealand like Lardy Dars who were well into it. Like they created a fantastic concept album already, and it, like they were way charging on. And slowly there was that thread building up in New Zealand. Like, you know, musicians, you guys can write and gals can write your own songs, you know what I mean? So, I mean, I put my head on, and when we went in there, I also started playing guitar.
I'm going to finish the second part of my interview with Glenn with a track written and sung by Glenn in 1977 when he was part of the iconic group Ariel.
It's only love. It's only love. It's only love. Words on and on.
This program is a Handsome Dog production and is podcast through the Toorak Times and TAG.